Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 11th of September. Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. He wrote in a piece in the Los Angeles Times, let me guess, you're concerned about the environment, you recycle, buy the right light bulbs, you drink from a reusable water bottle and wish you could afford a hybrid. You try to remember your reusable shopping bags when you go to the market and you feel guilty when you don't, but there's something you could be doing that would make a much bigger difference. And it's not one of those really hard things like carpooling to work or installing solar panels on your roof. All you need to do is minimize your food waste. If you buy it and bring it home, eat it. That alone is one of the easiest ways to aid the environment. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jonathan this hour, and later in the hour we'll learn how you can compost your food, which is very important to eliminating food waste, and it's mandatory in certain cities in this country. Here's our phone number for Jonathan Bloom, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can send messages on the computer, talk@WPR.org, or our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. So when you look around the USA, where do you see food waste?
Oh, I see food waste everywhere. And it's one of those things where once you start looking for it, you see it everywhere you go. And food waste starts at the farm and really happens at every step of the food chain on into our own homes. And so whether you're at a restaurant or supermarket or even having family or friends over for dinner, chances are there's going to be food wasted. And it's just a question of having our eyes opened and being able to see the amount of waste that's ubiquitous.
This percentage, it goes all the way up to 40% of the food being produced in the country not consumed, just is incredible, isn't it?
It is. It's pretty staggering to think that almost half of our food isn't being used. And to be sure, people in the food industry aren't setting out to waste food.
Right.
And certainly people at home aren't trying to waste food, but it's just become part of the way we do things. And as I said, it's ingrained at every step of the food chain.
You write about climate change coming directly from our kitchen. What do you mean by that?
Well, when we send food to the landfill, we are creating methane or creating greenhouse gases. When food decomposes in the landfill and does so without air, then it creates methane, which is 21 times as potent as CO2 at trapping heat. So we're aiding climate change from our kitchen waste bins. But then even before it gets to us, all of the resources, like oil and water in particular, that go into growing our food, all of those are embedded in the food that we then throw out. So when we squander food, we are actually squandering oil and water as well.
Do you have any kind of historical handle on this issue? We think about our ancestors who lived during very, very tough times in this country and didn't have very much money. Is there a correlation between the wealthier a society is and the amount of food that they waste?
Well, certainly, if we pay more for food, we are more careful with it. And in the U.S., we spend a very minuscule portion of our household spending on food. And it's at an all-time low. It's less than 10% of our household spending. So despite those rising food prices that you see, it's still a low proportion of our budgets. And no other nation spends as little on food as we do. And I would argue that there's a direct impact or a correlation. And because food doesn't really cost much, when we think about our whole budget, we don't tend to treat it carefully.
Mm-hmm. Even though it's fairly expensive to get our food from where it's grown to where we eat it frequently, you write about the trucking costs of food and the amount of food that we can waste because it just decays while it's on the truck, but it can be coming from as far away as 1,500 miles. So you've got fuel costs associated with that as well.
Yeah, certainly the long-distance food chain plays a role here, and that not only from an oil standpoint and the energy used to get our food there, but also that aids the decomposition of food in many cases. And the longer the food chain, the more opportunities there are for accidents and spills. And so there is a winnowing process the longer that food chain is. And then conversely, if we were to eat more locally, then a lot of the foods that wouldn't be shipped out because they wouldn't last that journey, a lot of those foods would be used. So if for example, there was a pear with a small blemish on it that the grower then knows isn't going to last 2 weeks from getting from California to into your kitchen, if that was at a farmer's market right in your own town, then you could just enjoy that the day or the next day, and it would be perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. Are there rules in place before we go to our own refrigerators, because that's where a lot of waste is, but are there rules in place for supermarkets and for restaurants in this country concerning the kinds of food that can be given away that may have a brief expiration date or one of those blemishes that you just talked about?
You know, there aren't any overarching rules on date labels. It's really a state-by-state situation. And that's one of the major problems when it comes to donating food, is that a national organization or even a multinational corporation, and they have to apply these state-by-state solutions. And in some cases, in most cases, those dates don't really mean that a food can't be used. It just means that it's not at its peak freshness. So there's a lot of misconceptions around date labels, and that's a real opportunity for us to reduce the amount of waste, both at home and in an institutional or retail setting.
Hmm. Do you have any rule of thumb measures that we ought to consider when we have something that's expired?
Well, my team of lawyers would advise me to be careful on the topic, to give a blanket advice, but and I'm joking, obviously. But we do want to be careful for sure. No one wants to get sick. But my best advice would be to use date labels as a guideline, mm-hmm. but not to treat them as the ultimate arbiter of when something's good or not. And trust your senses, to trust our sense of smell and taste and sight. And I think that we will know when things are bad or not. And if anyone out there isn't sure if they've ever smelled bad milk, that means that they haven't.
Right. Let's go to our refrigerators for a moment. I think that we can all remember times, probably fairly recently, when we've decided that something doesn't smell quite right and you got to clean out the whole refrigerator, and you find that you have 4 little cans of butter substitute, or you've got a whole lot of, you know, dill dip for your carrots for your children in your house, or whatever it is that somehow when we go grocery shopping, we forget what we have, or we buy way too much food and we wind up throwing food away. And I know it's a horrible thing to do. How do you keep from doing that?
The best advice I could give is for people to be smarter shoppers and to really take a step back and think about how we buy food. Oftentimes, we'll probably be buying too much when we really reflect on it. And if you were to actually look and see how much food you're not using, you'd probably see that the average home is wasting about a quarter of the food that they have. We don't really see it because it tends to just go away. It's either thrown out or down the disposal into the sink. But if we do take a step back and think about how much we're not using, then maybe buying less would be a proper solution, or perhaps making smaller, more frequent trips to the store. That's another strategy, rather than going once a week and making that huge shopping run and buying stuff that might not last the entire week.
You have to be a real stickler, I would think, for coming up with lists and for being very intentioned when you go shopping, because for many of us, myself included, shopping is this You go up and down the aisle. Oh, yeah, I think I need this. I think I need this. And you wind up with things you don't need. And it's simply resisting being organized about it.
Yeah, no, it's not easy for sure to resist those impulses. And the way supermarkets are created these days to act upon those desires and to cue us to buy certain items. So going in with a plan is probably a wiser approach. And, yeah, it is difficult, but it's not that hard. And I know I sound like a bit of a nag when I tell people to make a shopping list and then stick to it, but that is the way to avoid waste and the way to save money.
Mm-hmm. And what about in other areas? What about those vegetables that are left to rot in the field because they're not quite perfect? What about those hamburgers that haven't been sold in a day at a fast food restaurant?
Yeah, well, there are a number of nonprofit organizations, usually called food recovery groups or food rescue is another term, and these are a fabulous way to re-channel, redistribute some of the excess in our food system. So whether it's gleaning groups going out to fields and picking crops that otherwise wouldn't be picked, or volunteers going to a supermarket for that food recovery group and taking the excess food and putting it to good use. There's a nice safety net in many cities and towns, and that's a perfect way to use those edible but unsellable food items.
You include in your book this incredible, they're all incredible statistics, but U.S. supermarkets throwing away an estimated 30 million pounds of food every day. Whew! That's a lot of food.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a lot of food. It's a reflection of how we want our food to look, and it's sort of seen as a cost of doing business for many stores, especially with fresh foods. There's a perishability to produce and meats and seafood, and in order to have everything looking just so, being the right shape, size, and color, they have to discard a decent amount. And so the way we approach selling food is part of the problem. But in addition, our attitudes and how we expect perfection in our food is another source of waste.
Jonathan Bloom.
So there's some avenues for change there.
Bloom is our guest for most of this hour. Later in the hour, we'll learn about composting. For those of you who already know how to do this, you can tell us how you are going about this. And for those of you who would like to compost, which is a great answer, we'll get some valuable advice on how to do composting, which would take care of part of this problem in a substantial way. Jonathan is author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about wasted food this hour of our program. 40% of the food produced in this country is not consumed. What a waste. So what do we do about that? Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Tomorrow during this hour, this year marks the 100th anniversary of Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, the 28th president of this country. Our guest is Scott Berg, and he is the author of a huge book on Wilson, and it is titled Wilson. That's tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Let's go to Mark in Stevens Point, our first caller for you, Jonathan. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
I think that this is just just a symptom of a larger problem, really, the throwaway society that we live in today. You know, I've got a giving garden, and last year I did 3,200 pounds of food to the Salvation Army in Stevens Point, vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables. But you know, the issue with buying local and eating local really is, at least in Wisconsin, we don't have that opportunity to raise fresh vegetables year round. So we've got to preserve that. And I just think it's something, I don't even know if it's taught in our schools anymore. I mean, in the 70s, I mean, they taught even the boys in high school learned how to can and make jelly and jams and things like that. But I just think it's part of our larger problem that our society has today.
I think you're right, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, certainly canning food is a great way to make the summer's bounty last. And it is harder to eat locally year-round in certain parts of the country, for sure. But that just makes it all the more important that we learn how to make our food last through the winter. And, it's not an either-or or a black-or-white situation. I think if we can just become more local eaters in general, that doesn't mean that you have to go entirely local. And it's not a difficult thing to do if you approach it from that standpoint.
Where do you live, Jonathan?
I live in Durham, North Carolina.
Oh, you do? Oh, I lived in Durham for a few years. So you get a lot of fresh produce during the course of the year.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a farmer's market that's open year-round around me, but you certainly have some sparse months. But you could get by, but certainly it would be more difficult to eat locally there than in California or Florida.
Right. But should we make every attempt to just alter our diets and eat whatever foods are around in the fall, learn how to preserve them, and just eat foods when it's their time?
Well, I think should is a dangerous word. I think, of course, we should do that. But then in reality, when push comes to shove, we all are busy. And increasingly with more two working parent households, it's not easy to feed a family and to do it in a healthy way. So I'm an incrementalist and a realist. And so I think any kind of change is better than none. So maybe if you've never been to a farmer's market, stop by and see what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
And you might find you like it. And in particular, with respect to cost, that's a large barrier with many people. I've found that is somewhat of a mistruth. It can be more expensive, but maybe it's not. But I do think that when we support our local communities through farmers markets, support your neighbor or your friends, then you're helping to keep your community healthy. And there's a value in that, and that's part of what you're paying for.
Sure.
But then also, if you're paying more for your food, you're going to use more of it. And so maybe even buying less of protein than you would at the supermarket, but actually eating all of it as opposed to squandering a good amount.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mark, for your call. Nina posts on our Facebook page, what can be done to reduce the vast amount of food wasted in our schools? My children are in elementary school, and they bring food from home because of the waste I saw when I went to a parent lunch. I know one problem is that they have a minuscule amount of time to sit down and eat.
Yeah, well, certainly the short amount of time is a problem. That seems like something that we can fix through scheduling. I know that when kids do have enough time, they tend to eat a good amount of their food. The question is, what are they eating? And that gets into the nutritional questions. But to be honest, the more choice we have in our school lunches or even our own meals, the less waste there is. So to just have this ready-made tray, that one-size-fits-all approach, that ends up leading to a lot of waste. So hopefully there will be more options, more choices, and some schools are doing that for sure. And then one other really simple switch would be to shift the order of recess and lunch in the younger schools and to let kids play outside and build up an appetite and then come in and eat lunch. And you'd be amazed at the number of schools that do it in the opposite order, which just doesn't make much sense because kids are just focused on getting outside. And so half the lunch ends up in the trash bin.
Right. Thank you, Mark, so much for the call. Dana in Woodbury, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. I live in an area where a lot of times we have upscale supermarkets, so a majority of our consumers in my neighborhood are looking for that perfect strawberry, perfect tomato, because it's more about presentation in their food, because they probably entertain a lot, et cetera. And it appalls me to see nice food grocery stores that do waste the products that don't look as nice. And so I, as a consumer, and those of us who are concerned about food waste, I have a tendency to go ahead and pick the ugly orange and the ugly pear, or if I know I'm going to use bread or milk within the week, I choose the fastest or the quickest expiration date instead of taking one. You know, I see people reach way back to get the latest expiration date. If I know I'm going to drink it or eat it within that expiration date, then I go ahead and take that one, knowing that a majority of others, they don't want that. They want, you know, they want one that can sit in a refrigerator for a long time, even though they're going to do it quickly. So those of us who see this and are appalled by it because the waste is unbelievable, we can do small, tiny things, but as a group, we can make, hopefully, a big dent in stopping the food waste in the groceries, like buying the ugly thing that might get thrown away.
Sure.
But instead, since we've purchased it, then the pretty
things
are for those who don't care.
Right. Jonathan?
Well, yeah, bravo. I'm glad to hear that at least one person is doing that. Unfortunately, Dana is in the minority there, and not many people will buy the ugly produce or the foods near their date label. But certainly if we, more of us, were to do that and to communicate to stores that we're not that picky on our produce, we don't demand perfection, then that would lead to a good amount of waste. And I think one compromise on that matter would be to have discounted foods, maybe a discounted produce rack.
Sure.
Or items marked for quick sale. And some stores do that, to be fair, but not many. And from what I hear from the supermarket industry, they're leery of having anything that's not at its peak freshness in the store because they know that shoppers base their opinions of a store on the fresh foods. So that's where it's up to individual shoppers to communicate to the store that they would buy a discounted pear or apple that wasn't perfect, and that kind of blemished food or maybe misshapen items are perfectly fine, and that the most important part of food is the taste, not the appearance.
Thanks for the call, Dana. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jackie in Madison, hello.
I love that you've moved your show to the afternoons. I always had to miss it when it was in the morning. In my house, I actually grow most of our vegetables and do a lot of canning and preparation, but the same principle applies whether you're growing it or buying it. Buy food in bulk, and then we have cooking weekends at our house where my husband and I share the cooking. We cook for a month. We we learned this from friends of mine who did this with their children, and their children and the parents would do the cooking together for the weekend, and they'd learn things like chili, spaghetti sauce, some casseroles and things, all have the same tomatoes, peppers, onions, mushrooms as a base, so they could make all of that and then decide what to do later. And the children learned to cook, and it became a family event that actually became unmissable, and then they would invite friends, kids over and participate, and it becomes less of a chore and more of an event. And goodness knows, parents, if you can get your children to cook with you and take that chore off you, it seems like a really great opportunity.
Oh, yes, it does, Jackie. Yes, it does. That sounds like a really good idea, Jonathan.
Yeah, I like that strategy of planning ahead, and that brings up the idea of using your freezer as a waste preventer, or at least a waste delayer. And so many people don't take advantage of their freezer and see that it can be a nice tool to reduce waste. And it also gets into the notion of getting our kids back into the kitchens and getting more connected with our food. In the last few generations, we have become so disconnected from where our food comes from that we don't really know when things go bad, and we don't know how to repurpose foods or maybe transition one meal into another with leftovers.
Mm-hmm.
So any any way we can get kids cooking and involved with their food and connected to their food, that's a win in my book.
Mm-hmm. Jackie, thank you so much for your call. I know you were in town for an event on, it's a leadership, thought leadership event on lost and tossed food here in Milwaukee. Tell me about that panel. Who gathered? What did you learn?
Yeah, sure. Charleston Orwig, a communications company, they brought all these people together for a thought leadership event to look at food waste throughout the food chain. And there are really people from all levels, all walks of life, and all steps of the food chain. And we've had a really interesting discussion in trying to figure out what the problem is and where there might be solutions and what role there might be for food companies, and in particular, larger food companies.
Did you learn anything new?
Oh, goodness. I always pick up little things here and there, and I've learned a good amount today. In particular, thinking about the GMO crops, there's a lot of debate on whether or not those are a wise decision. Certainly, there's arguments on both sides, but from an efficiency standpoint and trying to minimize the amount of natural resources that go into growing our food, I think that's one benefit that's often overlooked. And then the other thing I've taken from today is just that the food industry wants to get involved. The issue of food waste is a train that is leaving the station. And in Europe, it has become an issue and one that most people there are focused on. And in particular in Britain, there's been a number of communications and some real successes in getting citizens to cut back on waste. And I think that food waste is going to become increasingly something we hear about. So food companies, being the forward thinkers that they are trying to get ahead of the curve and to try and figure out where they fit into this equation. And the majority of what I've seen is that those in the food industry want to help us, help consumers, cut back on waste. And we heard there was actually some polling done on opinions on food waste, and the majority of people asked said that they wanted to cut back on wasted food, but they didn't really know how. So to me, that's an opportunity. That's a chance for companies or even forward thinkers to step in and try and help people help themselves.
Mm-hmm. Christine in La Crosse, hi.
Hi. My comment kind of jumps back to how to reduce wasting things in our own households. I just wanted to mention that if you go online, there's a couple different websites out there where you can type in random ingredients or produce that you have at your house, and it'll give you different options as far as meal ideas. I apologize, I don't have the website because I'm not in my computer, but I think I just typed in how to use up random ingredients in my house, and it pulled up a couple different websites.
So what did you do? Can you give us an example?
As far as for...
What you may have had that was random that you put together and made something delicious.
Oh, I had, well, I had, what was the last one I did? Oh, I had fish, tilapia. I had orange peppers and yellow peppers. What else did I have mixed in there? Oh, I had artichoke hearts, brown rice, and... what was the last? Oh, olives. And what it had me do is basically a salsa idea with the peppers and the olives, and it also suggested getting tomatoes with that. It told me how to bake the fish, and then gave me some options as far as seasonings for the rice to make a better rice underneath it. And you can get even more random than that. That was just the last one I used, but...
Oh, I like that. I don't like to cook very much, Jonathan, and I'm really not very good at it. I'm not an art person, and I'm not a very good cook. But if I had somebody who could tell me what to throw together and make it taste good, that'd be dandy.
Yeah, well, maybe you should invite Kristen over. Team up.
Okay. All right.
She could teach you some things.
She probably could.
I think there are a lot of tools online to help anyone, really. figure out how to use their food. And gosh, there's so many recipes online these days that, you know, it's just a question of finding the time to cook, and provided there's that interest. But I think it's never too late to learn. That would be my advice. And I'm by no means a great chef or even a good cook, but I try. And it's a nice way to spend time with family or friends.
Yeah, no, it's a very nice thing to do. I just don't know how to do it very well. It's not a good thing. I'm not very proud of it, because I have friends who cook, and I'm real happy that they do that. But it is an art in some ways to make it a wonderful event and an artistic creation. Not that you can cook that way all the time, but I guess it may point to the fact that we all need to develop some of those skills, not only children, but old people like me as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just a matter of practice and doing it a bunch. And the more you cook, the easier it becomes. And I think lowering the bar on attractiveness and just admitting that it might not be a work of art your first few times out will help us cook, help us get past that barrier to entry in cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we cook, I think the healthier we eat and the less waste we will have in our homes.
Mm-hmm. Christine, thank you so much for your call. I'll go to that website go to the Google it and find out ways to put everything that you got in the refrigerator into a meal. We have time for a couple more phone calls. We're going to spend the last part of the show discussing composting. We started the hour by talking about how our refrigerators and our kitchens add to climate change and to global warming. So part of what would alleviate that in a fairly substantial way is composting. And for those who haven't done it or would like to upgrade what you're doing, we will have another guest who will discuss that specifically. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guest, Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. I know you have to catch a plane, Jonathan, just a couple minutes with you more. Are there other countries that are experiencing similar problems that have bigger waste problems than we do, or are we first in this category?
Well, the U.S., unfortunately, is leading the way in food waste, but the rest of the developed world is pretty close behind and catching up as our eating habits spread. But in the developing world, in some of the less fortunate places, there's a lot of food that isn't used, but it's usually called loss. It's usually put in a different category because it might be for factors like pests or drought or poor storage, poor infrastructure, no way to get your food to the market. So there's less culpability there, but a similar problem of food being grown for people not ending up in people's mouths. So there are problems really in all parts of the world with efficiency, and those are problems that we're going to have to tackle as the population on this planet increases, and especially as climate change rears its ugly head.
Yeah. You also talk about the financial cost of all of this. For the average family, it's well over $1,000, average family of four, in food that we just throw out every year.
Yeah, I was really shocked to hear that, and actually it's more than $2,000 by some estimates. So however you count it or however you slice it, the amount of money being wasted through food waste is significant. And it's the kind of thing where you don't really realize it, as we said, until you're looking for it. And then I'm sure anyone out there listening after today's show will be on the lookout for it and will probably see waste in their own homes.
I'm sure.
Certainly in restaurants and supermarkets.
Mike,
and that awareness is the key to making changes.
Mike in Hills Corners, hi.
Oh, hi there. Just want to comment, and maybe you covered this already. I'm sorry if I didn't hear this, but our system of food delivery is very inefficient. You know, here in America, we eat a lot of meat, for instance, and it takes a lot of corn or grain. You have to raise a lot of corn or grain to feed those cattle, and then then we eat those cattle in essence. If we ate the grain or corn directly, it would be, there would be much less waste of farmland and much less waste of food. I actually work for a company that grows mushrooms, and one of the things that we're promoting is if you mix like whatever your favorite ground beef meal is with ground mushrooms, like half and half, you actually have a just as tasty of a meal and less cost and, you know, healthier, much healthier. Half as unhealthy, I should say, as just a an all meat meal.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wondered if you had thought of, you know, the consideration there.
Jonathan?
Yeah, certainly the meat industry is pretty inefficient with its use of grain, or rather the production of meat calories is inefficient compared to what you might get from grains or even vegetables. But I think that argument doesn't take into account the fact that people have always eaten meat and probably always will. But I think your suggestion of maybe a middle path is a good one. And you know, being realistic about the approach, let's just try and eat a little bit less meat and maybe moving toward more local or grass-fed or sustainably raised meat products. That's a better approach to eating protein.
And one more call for you. Peter in Stoughton, hi.
Hi there. Just wanted to point out that prepared food, if stored properly, lasts a lot longer than most people seem to think it does. That pork loin, that leftover pork loin that you prepared last Thursday, is still going to be quite tasty for some other meal that you might prepare with it 5 days later. And people seem to have this attitude of, well, okay, it's been in the fridge for 3 days. Mm-hmm. I better throw it out. No, it lasts a long time, properly stored, whatever the meal is.
What do you mean by properly stored?
Oh, in a airtight container, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And preferably you'll have ones that you use repeatedly. But... yeah, put it in the fridge, keep your fridge at a good temperature, and that food is still going to be quite edible, and you won't be taking any risks with your health and well-being by mm-hmm. Eating it 5 or 6 days later. It's probably better for you that way.
Yeah, I don't think we even know the rules on that, Jonathan. We've got a lack of education here.
Yeah, we do. There's a deficit with food knowledge and with generations stepping out of the kitchen before this one, we are facing an uphill battle. So we need to get re-educated and figure out when we can use foods and when we can't. And there's actually an interesting campaign out there called 4-Day Throwaway. And this is a food safety campaign out of Iowa State University. And I spoke with their organizers, and basically, the rules are 4 to 7 days. That's sort of the guidelines that we get from the FDA, and they decided to err on the side of caution, which is probably a smart thing to do, but that's a good guideline, that they're about 4 to 7 days after cooking something if we store it properly.
Mm-hmm.
But that's knowing the right temperature guidelines, and we want to get those foods into the fridge as quickly as possible. Get it under 40 degrees if it's a hot item.
Mm-hmm.
As bacteria can't grow under 40 degrees. So, yeah, as long as we are proactive in saving our food, and I think leftovers is a great way to reduce waste, then people would probably be surprised how long things last.
Yeah. Peter, thanks very much for the call. Jonathan, we'll let you get your plane back to Durham, NC, and thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Some of what we can do, of course, is composting. And there are certain cities where composting is mandatory. That's pretty interesting. Do we see that expanding? What about basic composting? Our guest will talk about composting. He is the executive director of the Urban Ecology Center, and their family has done composting for a long, long time. So let's talk about that in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to talk about composting this hour. Did you know that Seattle and San Francisco have made household composting mandatory? Several years ago, Norway has banned food and biodegradable waste. And I would imagine since those years, many other communities have done the same. Ken Leinbach is executive director of the Urban Ecology Center here in Milwaukee. They're doing wonderful work at several locations. And he has written about composting, saying that he and his family have done this for years. And recently they harvested their household's yearly supply of dirt through composting. So how do you do that? We'll talk about it with Ken. Hi, Ken. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be on.
It is amazing to learn how valuable composting would be in actually dealing with global climate change and taking care of this huge waste problem we have with our food.
Yeah, no, it's indeed true, and it's always been something that's bothered me, really, since I was a kid. And so as composting has been part of my daily ritual, just like, you know, some people drive to work. It's just something that you do.
So you've been doing this for 15 years in the basement. What do you do?
Well, that's just the worm composting, the vermiculture in our basement. It's actually maybe even been a touch longer than that. But that's just a in the wintertime, when it's harder to compost outside because everything freezes, we got in the habit of just having a bin in the basement that's full of worms, and we put our food down there. So my kids, when they were growing up, had the chore wheel, and in addition to having to clean their room, one of the chores they had to do on a weekly basis was feed the worms or take the compost outside, depending on the season.
Uh-huh. And then how long does it take for it to turn into the beautiful dirt?
There's a lot of variables there, but it goes really quick. I mean, much quicker than I would ever anticipate, actually. So when I first started worm composting in the basement, I was very ginger with how much food I would put down there because I was thinking, well, the worms, there's no way they're going to eat all that. And what I discovered is that as much food as I put down there, they will multiply to the number of worms that are needed to turn it into dirt. So I no longer am shy in that way. The trick, though, is making sure that you don't just put food in, that you put a corresponding amount of roughage, and that can be anything from, you know, sawdust to leaf litter to hay.
Uh-huh. Do you do other kinds of composting as well, Ken?
Well, there's not really anything that's biodegradable that doesn't get composted in our household. I have two different bins. I have one for all of our food and yard waste, and then I have another bin for my animal waste outside. I keep them separate because the animal waste one shouldn't go where we're doing the garden. It just goes on our non-edible portions, you know, the soils that are created from that.
Uh-huh. So you do animal waste composting,
well,
too.
Well, and just to be clear, this is not something that a lot of people don't recommend that you do this.
Mm-hmm.
But being the sort of the green nut that I am, I experiment with all sorts of different things. And so, I've been doing animal waste for quite a long time with great success.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I shouldn't necessarily recommend it because it doesn't seem like it's what a lot of people recommend. But it's been working for us.
Yeah. Now tell me about is this all outdoor? Are your bins outside or are they in your kitchen too?
We have under my sink, there's a bin that we put all our food scraps in, and that's in the kitchen. And then where that goes is depending on the season. So if it's in the wintertime, that goes into the basement to the worm bin, which is like maybe a 25 gallon, you know, Tupperware container in the basement that's got some holes in to drain the worm juice out, which we also use as fertilizer. And then if it's in the spring, summer, or fall, that all goes outside. And all the leaves that fall in our yard,
mm-hmm.
We're fortunate that we have a yard. Not everybody does, but we have all the leaves that fall in our yard. I chew them up with our electric lawnmower, and they all get composted as well. I don't put anything on the street because why should I give those nutrients to someone else and have someone haul them away with all the fossil fuels that takes?
Mm. So where do you put them?
I have a pile for my leaves, and I turn my leaves just like I turn everything else, maybe once every 3 weeks with a pitchfork. And then when I put food waste into, or animal waste, depending on which bin I'm using. I always cover them with some leaves so the rodents don't get at them. And it's once you get in the habit, it's like super easy.
Uh-huh. So once you get in the habit of all of this, is it fairly time consuming or just or not?
No. The only. I mean, it's really not time consuming at all. It's you have to. If you're going to throw something away, you got to put it somewhere. So it's the amount of time it takes you to take it to the trash can is the same amount of time it takes to take it to a bin outside. So there's really no difference there. You know, literally once every 3 weeks or so, I take a pitchfork and a shovel and I turn my piles, and that takes maybe 10 minutes. And then in the fall. Well, it's not always consistently fall, but usually it's in the fall. I have the fun of actually harvesting the dirt that's been created and putting it on my garden.
Hmm.
And that takes a little time, but it's like, that's the fun part. I enjoy that.
Right. And if everybody did something like that, not even as extensively as what you're doing, it would make a huge difference, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would. I mean, that's sort of the whole thing that we do at the Urban Ecology Center is it's, you try to get everybody to do their little bit. And it's the things you can control that actually has power in the world. And if we all do it, then you can actually see a shift begin to happen.
Right. Let's take a couple phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we're talking about composting. Ken Leinbach is executive director of the Urban Ecology Center based in Milwaukee and does extensive composting, as you've heard. Helen in Mountain is calling for you. Hi, Helen.
Hi. When we built our home up between Mountain and Lakewood 6 years ago, I purposely did not put a garbage disposal in because I was looking forward to composting. But our problem are the bears, and I'm one, and we have two Cocker Spaniels, so I don't want to attract the bears in. Does he have any hints for composting so that you don't attract bears?
Yeah, I don't have bears in Milwaukee, so that's something I've had to deal with. But I have had to deal with bears in other places. And if you get an ornery bear, there's not a whole lot you can do because they just smell out pretty much everything. Just like any rodent or animal, if you build a compost bin that's completely enclosed, and in our case it's with hardware cloth, and then every time you put food into it, you make sure you cover it. As I was mentioning, with in our case, I always use the shredded leaves. The odors don't pervade, and you're not as likely to attract an animal like that. To be totally honest, though, if once the bear discovers the smells, the hardware cloth bin isn't going to keep the bear out. So there's not a whole lot you can do with that.
Thank you, Helen, for your call. Stella in Sturgeon, hi.
Hi. First of all, I want to put in a plug for the Urban Ecology Center. It is absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
And everybody should visit it.
Thank you very much.
And I just wanted to mention, when you were talking about your vermiculture, your worm farm in the basement, what we do with ours for the roughage that you were talking about,
yeah,
is when we get packages... excuse me, that are packed, the packing material is brown paper packing material.
Right.
I shred it up, and that's what we feed our worms.
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant. And I should mention, we use shredded paper as well. I mean, I use kind of what's ever available, but shredded paper is definitely something that we use.
Mm-hmm.
And they gobble it up.
Yeah.
Thank you, Stella. Thanks for the call. Are there websites, or do you have something on an Urban Ecology Center website that gives people more information if they're just starting all of this?
Websites out there. It's pretty easy to find.
Okay.
And I'll make sure that we get on our website, for example, the worm bin that we recommend people can build. As something, I know we've had it on in the past, but since I'm on the air right now, I'll make sure we get it on our website in the next day or two as well again, because a lot of people like that.
Yeah, okay. And what's the website, Ken?
It's just urbanecologycenter.org.
All right. And you are doing wonderful work, and it keeps expanding in the city. It's really nice.
Yeah, thanks.
Yep. Good for you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Ken Leinbach is executive director of the Urban Ecology Center. He said he put it back up on their website, in case you're interested in getting a worm bin in your basement or wherever. So that's Urban Ecology Center. And we'll put that on our website, too, because why not? And that's Well, our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. So thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. And please stay tuned, because there are interesting conversations ahead. Tomorrow, we're going to be with you again. We love doing presidential biographies every now and then, and there's a lot of information out about Woodrow Wilson, because it's the 100th year this year that he was inaugurated. So the author of Wilson will be joining us tomorrow to talk about his presidency. Thanks for listening. News ahead from National Public Radio, and then Central Time with Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickard, and we'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.